This is Cast of Wonders, the young adult fiction podcast featuring stories of the fantastic. Welcome as we continue our Banned Books Week special, exploring censorship, the freedom to read, and the power of literature to enrich and inspire our lives. Episode 230 for September 27th, 2016. We present Problematic by Brian Lawrence Harrell, a Cast of Wonders original. Brian Harrell is a lifelong science fiction fan and is especially fond of Golden Age stories from the 40s and 50s. His fiction has appeared in the science journal Nature and magazines such as Daily Science Fiction and Bête Noire. A former high school English and history teacher, he now makes a living as a technical writer and communications consultant. His previous occupations over the years include machine assembly, carpet installer, cab driver, and U.S. Marine. He lives in New Jersey with his wife and son, and we'll have a link for his Twitter page in the show notes. Your narrator is Tatiana Gray, a critically acclaimed actress of stage, screen, and the audio booth. She's been nominated for dozens of fancy awards, but hasn't won a single damn thing. She went to NYU and lives in Brooklyn, New York. Again, we'll include a link to her website and Twitter account in the show notes. And now we've a tale to tell.
Problematic by Brian Harrell. The main office is as Spartan as the rest of the campus. Three plain gray metal folding chairs arranged in front of Headmistress Denali's equally plain and unadorned wooden desk. In one of the chairs, the slim 10-year-old frame of Luna Vega McPherson squirms restlessly, twisting strands of dark curly hair around a forefinger, and not at all trying to disguise her boredom. In the other two chairs sit her parents, looking equally uncomfortable, but for different reasons. I confess to taking some degree of pleasure in the final phase of the application process. Call it a guilty pleasure. But I do so enjoy seeing overbearing parents humbled. Since the Banks Institute is self-financing and offers only full scholarships or flat-out rejection, those of means have no more influence than those without. The headmistress's face is deeply lined and wizened, her gray hair drawn into a severe bun. Through a pair of ancient wire-rimmed bifocals, complete with a thin chain securing them loosely behind her neck, her dark eyes regard the three seated guests intently.
"I understand your concerns, Mr. McPherson," she says with all business crispness, her Gujarati-spiced lilt sounding far more youthful than one might expect. "But don't let the lack of bells and whistles fool you. Our graduates include more than a dozen current and former state representatives, two governors, three founders of Fortune 500 companies, and more scientists, engineers, entrepreneurs, and artists of varying stripes than I can recall without having to look them up."
That's utter hogwash, of course. Miss Denali knows the current professional disposition of each and every student that has ever passed through these unassuming halls.
"Our athletics program," she continues, "despite its limited size, competes on equal footing with all of the local high schools in team sports. In individual sports, we surpass them. And of course, our academic program is, without a hint of exaggeration, second to none."
The father pauses, shifts, straightens.
Yes, I know.
He clears his throat with a cough, looks down and briefly picks at something invisible on his tie.
"But the academics, well..."
The mother, her face twitching with impatience, steps in and blurts,
"Gregory's concerned about the..."
She pauses, inhales as if preparing to hold her breath for a deep plunge into a cold sea, then spits out,
"The problematic parts of the curriculum."
Is the hint of a smile twitching at the corners of headmistress's tightly pressed lips? I can't be sure.
"Problematic parts?"
She feigns confusion.
"Dear me, have we gone and let the problematic parts infect our curriculum? I had no idea. Some headmistress I must be."
"We heard," the father begins.
The headmistress ignores him, her sharp enunciation flowing over and dousing Mr. McPherson's brief, hesitant stammer.
"As a private institution," she states, "we are not bound by amendment revisions, nor subject to the Trigger Act, as are public schools."
"But," protests the father, "surely there must be some materials and..."
"Mr. McPherson!"
Mr. Nolly again cuts him off.
"There are no half measures in a Banks Institute education. In for a penny, in for a pound. This is an all-or-nothing opportunity."
The headmistress has not raised her voice beyond conversational levels, but the father nonetheless shrinks into his chair like a chastened schoolboy. He glances questioningly at his wife. She nods.
"Okay," he concedes. "Okay, but how long before we know if she's accepted?"
"It will take some time to weigh the various candidates. You must understand that competition for slots is fierce, and unfortunately, even some of the best and brightest are not accepted."
She looks down at Luna's open file folder spread across her desk.
"This is, of course, no reflection of their abilities. Were your daughter not already an outstanding student, she would not have made it this far."
I nod sagely, to add emphasis to Miss Denali's words. The parents smile at the compliment, looking over at Luna, who is studying intently something fascinating on the hem of her sundress.
"Now, there is a waiver we are required by law to provide, but it will be the only one. After that, if your daughter is accepted, there will be no turning back, no preferential treatment, no cherry-picking literature, no special dispensations."
Again the father looks to the mother. Again she nods.
"Very well," says the headmistress, turning to me. "Miss Kulik, would you be so kind as to escort the young mistress to the library while we continue?"
"Yes, Miss Denali."
"Come along, Luna, and let's have a look around the school."
Luna jumps to her feet, obviously overjoyed to get out of the cold, hard chair in the cold, hard office with the cold, hard old lady.
"Everyone calls me Lunita," she sings.
"Well, then, I shall call you Lunita as well. And you may call me Miss Kulik."
As we walk out, I hear the rustle of paper as the headmistress begins reading.
"You are hereby advised that should your child be accepted to attend the Banks Institute, they will undertake a rigorous course of study. Further be advised that your child will be exposed to works of art and literature that might include depictions of violence, substance abuse, broken families, misanthropy, misogyny, suicide, matricide, patricide, fratricide, potentially upsetting depictions of privilege, colonialism, sexism, homosexism, heterosexism, cissexism, class warfare, global warfare, harsh language, cruelty to animals."
The door closes behind us and we start down the hall.
"What's matricide?" asks Luna.
Over the years, I have amassed a vast catalog of canned responses to such inquiries, as there is an ever-growing list of trigger words, which, by law, I cannot discuss with or define for anyone under the age of 21 without a signed release. I reply without hesitation.
"You know those tags on mattresses that say it's against the law to remove them?"
"Yeah, my brother says you'll go to jail if you rip them."
"Exactly. That's matricide.
And right at the end of this hall is the library."
Luna gazes at the rows of book-lined shelves and scattered tables and chairs with a frown of blank confusion.
"Where are all the computers?"
"There are none."
"I thought this was a library."
"It is."
"How do you download books, then?"
I smile at that.
"You download them here." I tap my left and right index fingers on my temples. "With these," I add, moving the fingers inwards to point at my eyes.
"Oh," says Luna simply.
I step to the shelf and pull out a book. The title, by law, has been blacked out, but the cover illustrations have been allowed to remain.
"See?"
The young girl twists her mouth in a frankly quizzical grimace.
"There's no screen."
"It's not that kind of a book."
Her mouth drops open in silent awe, eyes widening, a sudden awareness flashing within her bright green eyes. She flinches visibly, recoils back a step.
These are those books.
She gapes, her voice barely above a whisper. Those books?
The ones that are...
She hesitates.
Problematic.
She pronounces the word slowly, sounding out the four syllables.
Yes, potentially harmful. Do you know what potentially means?
Of course,
she says, regaining her preteen composure.
It means it might be or it might not be.
Exactly.
It looks like a box, like a big flat box of chocolates.
It's very much like a box. A Pandora's box, perhaps, though I dare not say it, as that can be misconstrued as a sexual reference. Her parents are likely still listening to the 17-page list of actionable content and have not yet signed the waiver.
What's in it?
Oh my, where would I start? Let's just say a story.
There's a big man and a boy on a raft.
Yes, and they're on a journey, and this tells that story.
Is this one of the books that can hurt you?
Well, it has things that might make you feel bad.
And traumatized.
Well, better to change the subject. I place the volume on the table and pull out another. Her face twists into a grimace of horror.
Is that man gonna kill that whale with a spear?
You'd have to read it and find out. Another book.
They look like firemen, but they're shooting fire instead of water.
Another.
That's a dragon.
A flicker of enthusiasm edges into her voice.
And a little person.
And one more.
That's just a half-bald guy with a ruffly collar. Boring.
Perhaps, I laugh. Shakespeare alone fits into no less than 73% of the actionable content categories.
I have to organize some shelves. You can look around if you like while we wait for your parents to finish up. But whatever you do,
I sweep my hands dramatically over the scattered books and with a conspiratorial whisper say,
be very careful with these.
She stares at me exactly as one would expect a preteen to stare at an adult who has just made a big show of stating the stupidly obvious. I turn and walk off, stepping between two sets of shelves and making a show of examining and rearranging the volumes. But I watch her through the gaps. She looks around, then wanders away from the table to the windows, gazes at the woods beyond the soccer field, turns and comes back to the scattered books. She slowly circumnavigates the table, examining the covers. Occasionally, her hand darts out and delicately brushes the faded gilt page edges. She ignores the bard completely, shuns the firemen and their flamethrowers, avoids the harpoon aimed at the white whale. But the unlikely pair on the raft and the little person facing down the dragon hold her attention.
Come on, kid,
I silently implore, not daring to even mouth the words. Luna slips her fingers under the edge of a buckram-bound frontboard, the one emblazoned with the red dragon, yanks the hand back, as if it had been singed, tilts her head, reaches out once more. We return to the main office to find Headmistress Denali and Luna's parents in the hallway. She shakes their hands, thanks them for coming, and tells them they will be informed as soon as possible whether there will be a place for their daughter this coming fall.
Goodbye, Lunita,
I call after them as they collect their daughter and head out. Miss Denali watches them go, then turns to me, eyebrows arched. I say nothing, but my face tells her all she needs to know. She nods curtly, then disappears into her office. I walk the long walk back to the library, my mind awash in memories of the day I had first stood before that little round table. 5 books, 5 illustrations, 5 blacked-out titles. I remember the battle of wills between my childhood curiosity and the warnings of peril and pain, of how words could conjure up my darkest fears.
As a child, I had imagined that the books were living things, imbued with a magic great and terrible. Had even fancied they had trembled and shivered, barely containing the mysteries between their rigid covers, the dreadful unknowns which might be released by the mere act of opening the cover and laying bare the words within. Words, which once seen, could not be unseen. Sometimes, even now, I'm not sure it was my imagination at all. I stop at the small round table. Upon it lay the 5 volumes, resting exactly where they had been set down. Undisturbed. Unopened. Dear Miss Vega and Mr. McPherson, I wrote in the graceful looping cursive that Miss Denali had painstakingly taught me not so many years ago. The flowing and elegant script I now taught my own students would teach all the new students who would arrive in the fall. But Luna would not be among them.
I want to read you the author's comments on this story. Quote, "In more than half a decade of teaching English, I have never had a parent opt their child out of reading a particular work of literature, though I know it does happen on occasion. As a parent of a minor, that is certainly their right. And to be honest, some of the more adult themes and language used in some of the works I taught, including Fahrenheit 451 and 1984, especially those dealing with racism and violence, made me a little uneasy at times. As it happened, I tended to underestimate my students' maturity and ability to understand, process, and otherwise deal with controversy. As previous generations have found out time and again since, oh, perhaps 4000 BC, the younger generation are far more astute and adaptable than we might believe. However, it is with some dismay that I recently began to hear about college students at some universities starting to demand that works they deem objectionable or potentially harmful either be removed from the curriculum or come with some kind of warnings attached. This way, if my understanding is correct, those students who chose to do so may avoid any potential harm that might come from exposure to such works. However well-intentioned, this kind of outlook is both alien and anathema to me. Literature, be it fiction or nonfiction, is a mirror of the real world, and avoiding a work of art that might confuse, anger, terrify, or frustrate you is like avoiding life itself. Real life is often confusing and angry and terrifying and frustrating, and the only way to grow as a person and citizen of the world is to face it, both in our daily lives and in the books we read. Avoidance is never a good solution, and avoiding certain books, whether one would have ended up cherishing them or despising them, is a form of self-exile." End quote. We as a society are embroiled in a difficult conversation about content. On one end of the debate, we have organizations and individuals who support the assertion that creative endeavors are a wide church, and that some content warrants identification in advance, so that readers who might find difficulty with the subject can make informed choices as to how or if they engage with that work. Content notes, sometimes called trigger warnings, aren't the same as ratings like on television programs or movies. I like to think of them as those brightly colored warning flags you see on the back of vehicles carrying caustic or harmful substances. They exist to identify and warn, not censure. Sometimes content warnings contain spoilers. I'll put a link to Fireside Fiction's excellent rating system in the show notes for those seeking an example. On the other hand of the debate, we have positions like those Brian articulately expresses. Anytime an individual intentionally removes themselves from a subset of content, there is the potential that their interaction with a fictional work may not be all it could be, or may differ from what the creating artist intended. This side of the debate sees content warnings as more black and white, and argue that any attempt to alter or to some extent even warn someone away from a work's full impact crosses the line into censorship. Even further afield are those who claim content warnings are an insult to readers, and their very use posits readers as unstable, damaged, and teetering on the edge of imminent collapse into crisis. Ultimately, it comes down to choice, a word I use intentionally for its parallel to the abortion debate. Choices are made on behalf of the young by their parents and guardians. Choices are sometimes made on behalf of adults who are unable to make those choices for themselves. But where we go from there, when we become comfortable with the ability to impose choice on others, becomes a slippery soap of ableism, racism, sexism, colonial history, and the full gambit of not-so-noblesse oblige. Whether or not to avail yourself of a warning label is itself a choice, a deeply personal one. Every person who comes to an artistic work brings their own expectation, bias, and history with them. My experience reading Fahrenheit 451 will be different to that of someone who survived ethnic cleansing. My disconnect with A Fault in Their Stars may stem from having never interacted deeply with a loved one battling cancer. My frustration and anger at television shows portraying farcical versions of modern jurisprudence differs from those who aren't practicing lawyers and are the stuff of Twitter rant legend. Is anyone wrong? No, not for every case. Is anyone right? Again, no. Not in every circumstance. No one person has ever existed who has experienced everything there is to experience and can provide an impartial external opinion. No black and white answer can service such a rich field of gray. Our Banned Book Week special concludes next episode with This Story Begins With You by Rachel K. Jones. Our special donation call this episode is the Freedom to Read Foundation, an advocacy group that deals with a wide range of issues affecting our freedoms of speech and our right to access information. A growing part of their mission is to educate librarians, library patrons, and the general public about issues related to the freedom to read. We'll have a link for their website in the show notes. You can share your appreciation for this story by leaving us a review on iTunes or wherever you acquire your podcasts. Our stories are designed with a commute in mind, so please share the episode with your friends and family, or coworkers if you carpool. You can discuss what you thought of the story on the EA forum, forum.escapeartists.net, and we're at Cast of Wonders on Twitter. Come and say hello. Cast of Wonders is a production of Escape Artists Incorporated and is brought to you by the creative team of assistant editors Danny Daly and Catherine Inskip, along with our entire Slush Reading team. Our audio producers are Jeremy Carter and Ricky Lacoste, and I remain, as always, your humble editor and host, Marguerite Kenner. Our episodes are released under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives 4.0 International License. You can share the episode or listen to it on any device you like, but you can't change it or sell it. Our theme, Appeal to Heavens, is by Alexi Nam from MusicAlley.com. Thanks for listening.